Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. Today we are traveling to Australia, back to 1982 for the musical comedy Starstruck. This Australian film was directed by Gillian Armstrong and stars Joe Kennedy and Ross O'Donovan. So, Dad, why did you pick this particular film?
So, I picked it for a couple of different reasons. When I started really following films when I was a teenager, it coincided with two type of films starting to show up in Seattle where I was growing up. One was Hong Kong films, and the other one was Australian films. The Hong Kong and Australian films from that era have a special spot in my heart, so I wanted to go back and revisit some of those films. This film also is a film that isn't listed usually with a lot of those Australian films because it's kind of out there on its own. It's a comedy musical. A lot of Australian films were either art house period pieces or what we would call exploitation films that were genre films or grindhouse type style films. So I really enjoyed this film because it's kind of out there on its own. And so I wanted to go back and revisit it. There's also some other reasons I'm feeling kind of nostalgic about how we used to go and discover these films. So we'll talk about that a little bit later.
So for anybody who hasn't seen the film, here is just a little rundown of the plot.
Jackie Mullins, a young woman who works and lives in a pub with her family, including her 14-year-old cousin Angus, dreams of becoming a famous Australian singer. One day, through mischief caused by Angus's management style, she lands a spot on The Wow Show, a TV talent agent show. Under the guise of a crush on the host of the show, Terry Lambert, she is convinced to drop her backing band, The Wombats, Angus, dress more conventional, and sing a more poppy sound, which backfires. After finding out that Terry is gay and therefore not romantically interested in her, Jackie reconciles with the band and Angus. When tragedy strikes in the form of Angus's scheming father romancing Jackie's mother, Pearl, and stealing money from the pub, Angus, Jackie, and the Wombats plan to crash the Wow Show's New Year's Eve show dressed as stage crew in order to win the $25,000 grand prize and save the pub. Does the plan work? Does Angus and Jackie fulfill their dreams? Do they save the pub? It's a musical comedy, and of course, they do.
So, Dad, how did you originally see this movie?
So, this movie came out in 1982 in Australia. I think it had a very limited run in the States, but I'm not sure. When I started dating your mom, we started talking about things that we both liked. And one of the things that we liked was cult films. We also connected on the fact that we liked Australian films. And this was a film I hadn't seen that she loved. So, of course, one of our dates was to watch this film. And she really shared it with me. It was a great memory of mine. And so the first time I saw this film was on VHS in your mom's apartment. And it's always had a fun little spot in my head, which is why I wanted to watch it again. So I enjoyed this film for various reasons. I just wanted to know, when we were watching this film, how did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's really good. I think it's going to be one of the movies that I hold on to. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of Strictly Ballroom in the same tone. And it Strictly Ballroom also happens to be around an Australian film produced and directed around this time that this movie came out. But they both have a quirky sense of humor, which makes me realize why mom loves this movie so much and why you love this movie so much.
Yeah, so one of the things that I really like about this film, and it's one of the reasons why every now and then I have gone back and watched this film, not only is it about a bunch of kids that are doing the can-do, we're putting on a show storyline, very similar to the 1930s stories of Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland movies where they were putting on a show so they could save something or do something. It also had, you could tell by the making of it, that was the attitude of the the director and the crew is like, we're putting on a show. We can do this. We can make a musical comedy. And it was a lot of fun. So for me, it's one of those movies where the energy and the performance behind it outweighs some of the flaws or production value that you can see in the film. I really like when I'm starting a new project, something like this podcast, or when trying to write a screenplay or writing short stories, that it's just one of those things that you watch films like this to kind of remind yourself and get yourself in that mindset of that can-do attitude. There is no option for failure. It's going to work, even though there's all these obstacles. It just helps your brain kind of go, yes, this can work out. Yes, don't get so hung up on the process. Just go out and do it. And so it's one of those movies that, like I said, holds a spot in my heart because it has that can-do attitude.
I really do enjoy the energy of this film as well, and I think it's a great testament to energy over skill. There's a lot of actors out there that we all enjoy, but we all agree that they could get better in their acting skill, but we still hire them because we love their energy. And I think this film has a great persona around it. It's pretty much, in my opinion, this movie is the equivalent of like a pink wall that you just throw glitter at. It's a really fun movie, which is one of the reasons why when Mom showed me Strictly Ballroom when I was like two or whatever, I really connected with it because it has this can do, we're going to do it, we're going to beat the odds attitude. And if you're a friend of mine, you already know that Strictly Ballroom is literally the only Baz Luhrmann movie that I can stand. And I think one of the reasons why I really enjoy this film and Strictly Ballroom is that it's a bare bones story with fantastic characters.
Yeah, so go back a little bit on this, is that in the 70s, you kind of had this rebirth of Australian cinema, and towards the end of it, you had all these new directors coming out, and Gillian Armstrong was one of them, and in 79, she directed My Brilliant Career. And then after that, she was afraid that she was going to get typecast as doing period pieces, so she was looking for something more contemporary and different. The thing that she gravitated to was the script that she had seen and heard about called Starstruck, which was this supposed to be this musical that was based on the screenwriter's life. He grew up around a pub that his mom was a barmaid at. It was a very personal story on one level, and two, that she thought it would be fun to do a musical. And what that meant was that they had to go and cast two young leads to play Jackie and Angus. And they had a huge casting call, and it came down to six couples. And when Joe Kennedy and Ross O'Donovan came in, they blew everybody away with their energy and how well they bounced off of each other and worked off of each other. The problem was both of them had very little experience. And you can kind of see it in the film. There's times where they're a little raw in their delivery or their acting. But at the same time, like I said, it's that movie where their personalities overcome that. They show a lot. And Ross O'Donovan, you see his character is probably really close to how he is. And Joe Kennedy, her character of Jackie, is very similar to how she was at the time. But their energy just pops off the screen. So I think they made the right choice in going with young, inexperienced actors, even with all the problems that led to while they were filming. They had to literally train them from the bottom up how to dance, how to sing on camera, how to move through a shot. All those things they had to walk them through.
I mean, this is a movie about not knowing what you're doing and starting from scratch and building yourself up as you go. So I feel like their casting was perfect for this movie. Their quirkiness allows them to add to the film. I also think that it's really awesome because their chemistry on camera leads to us feeling like they're family, like they've grown up with each other since day one.
Well, that's one of the things that Gillian Armstrong said in when we were one of the interviews she said about the film was that because they had to train everybody, including the background actors, to sing and dance and for the musical numbers, there was like a 6-week, I don't know what to say, boot camp. It's not really, but like a training camp where they could sit there and train the all these character actors and all the main actors on how to dance and sing for the cameras and go through the numbers. And she said that because they were all in on it together, by the end of this training, they were all family. They were all laughing together. They were all leaned on each other through the filming process. And you can see that coming through the film. When the bar people are cheering for Jackie's performance, you really feel that they're cheering for the performance. And I think that lends itself. If you're going to use people who aren't the most experienced, building that camaraderie really helps showing that through the film. So one of the things that they had to do while making this film is a musical. So that meant they were going to rely on different people for songs. And they ran into a problem because even though they were spending all this time trying to find songs, what was coming back to them wasn't very good. And they commented on the fact in a couple of different interviews that they were scrambling by the end to find songs.
When you're writing a musical, I'm confused if it's like the Hamilton way, in the sense of like you have five songs and now it's your turn to choose how you want the narrative to go, or like this kind of way where it's like I have a script and the script says enter song here. Now we have to figure out the song. So I just always am interested on how they write musicals, because I like musicals. I'm not a singer and I'm not a musical performer. I'm just a human. I can never do anything that they do. So it always just interests me on how they write a musical, and it was very cool insight how musicals were made.
So yeah, so this film definitely went the other way where they had the screenplay and they were trying to find songs that would fit into the story and move story along. So they didn't just stop and perform a musical that didn't make or a song that didn't make sense for the plot point, but also be in that new wave sound, because that's what they were going for. This was going to be a new wave musical.
I also, while watching the movie, realized that one of the reasons why you guys really enjoy this film is because of the music.
Well, ironically, no.
Really? Because I really enjoyed this music, and I can see why Mom would enjoy this music, because it's very similar to the things that she has on her shelf.
Yeah, so when she grew up in this film, and she saw this film in the 80s, this was very similar to the music she liked. And these were bands that she knew of. Split Enz was definitely one of those bands that influenced a lot of the Australian and New Zealand new wave bands that came out at that time. And two of the people that wrote songs for this movie were from Split Enz. One of them, by this time, Split Enz had broken up when they started to film the movie. And one of them, Phil Judd, had his new band, The Swingers, in the movie. And Tim Finn also wrote a song for the movie. So it really had that classic New Zealand, Australian new wave sound. But when I was in the 80s, I was a little bit more on the rock side of things. So it wasn't necessarily music I wasn't not listening to, but it wasn't my first go-to. So that's why I said ironically no. But one of the things about living in Seattle, you kind of forgotten, you're up in the Northwest, is that if you ever listen, you went to record stores and everything was kind of open. You weren't like, you would buy records from different genres. I remember liking everything from heavy metal to new wave, a little bit of rap here and there in the 80s. And then I had friends who were really into punk and rap with a little bit of heavy metal. And so it all crossed over.
I just want to add something. I also, it might not necessarily just be because you live in Seattle, but because you had an opportunity to do that, because you could go to the record store and there would be like seven different records and somebody could say, hey, if you like this one, you can like this one. But now that we have Spotify and Apple Music, it's always like, if you like Ariana Grande, you will only listen to Ariana Grande. And if you chance to go outside, you will go to these three people who were heavily inspired by Ariana Grande.
Well, yeah, there is that aspect of listening to music in that era, is that there was an opportunity to walk through record stores and walk through and having different people, having your friends recommend stuff. There was always that older brother, older sister that would be listening to something that would influence you. Or you go to a record store and somebody would say, hey, I noticed you liked this band would be somebody to listen to. And so there was that aspect, but I do believe there is a thing with Seattle in the 80s, especially, where you would go to some of these record stores and they had huge selections of the ones that I'm thinking of were fairly large, and they weren't corporate record stores. They were independent record stores, and they had these huge selections, and the people there would recommend stuff to you. And then you start talking and go, oh, hey, do you also like this type of music? And you would go, okay. And so it was very common to go to parties and you'd have everything from Motley Crue to Bob Marley to Crowded House all playing that same night off of somebody's selection.
One of the things that I like about this movie is that it captured a moment in time before something amazing happened. This movie was filmed before MTV even existed. MTV as MTV originated, not as MTV is now. And one of the things that is really cool is that this movie came out and people were really confused by these Australian new wave bands. But then 6 months to 9 months later, MTV launched, and Australian bands like Men at Work, INXS, and Crowded House, they were already making videos for Australia. And so when MTV came around, they already had videos ready. And so there was a huge boom in America for Australian new wave bands 6 months to 9 months after this movie came out. Unfortunately, this movie did not get a boost from that, but it's still an interesting thought.
This movie didn't get a boost from it because there's two reasons. One, there wasn't a specific band that was in the movie that they could point to and say, this was the band from Starstruck, because the band, the Wombats, was a created band in the movie. That's the band that backs up Jackie's character in her pursuit to win the award. There is another band called the Swingers that is Phil Judd's new band that he had made right after breaking up with Split Enz, but they weren't like the featured band. They were just like a band that played in the background. So there wasn't a band you could point to in this movie and say that was the band and people would go find this movie to watch. So yeah, it didn't really help the movie in America. And in Australia, there was kind of that feeling of the same thing. They all knew the bands, and there wasn't that band that was in the movie that made people want to go see the movie. So there was a little bit of that working against them.
But that being said, when people started to enjoy new wave music in Australian films, it definitely became popular. It became a cult classic with the strong few who really enjoyed those types of things.
From my younger years about this movie and how it connected with me is, in general, was that I really enjoyed films that came out of Australia, New Zealand, and Hong Kong. Living in Seattle at the time, there were various places where you could go see them. There was the Repertory Theaters. There was actually one. It was the Neptune, which eventually moved over to the Varsity. I forget when that move happened, but what they would do is they'd publish for a month. Every night was a different movie or series of movies, or there was like a theme for that week, or every Tuesday was a certain style of film, like spaghetti westerns or something like that. And then there was second run house theaters like the Crest, which I lived by, so I could ride my bike to. And the second run, the thing about that I liked about that theater was there was movies I couldn't go down into the city to see because they were too far away. And they were like, because of second run, they would have everything from Das Boot to Mad Max to, they would have like an art house film that I had not seen. And so it was a very good eclectic mix. So those were where I would find these movies, and it was really fun because you would see things like, I remember I watched Das Boot and Road Warrior as a double bill in that theater. And that's just a really fun double bill because they're two very different films. But in my brain, somehow, it just kind of worked. So that's how I kind of view film now is it's all part of a palette. There's different colors, textures, different filmmakers lend different things, and you should be able to appreciate all of it and have fun watching all of it. And I usually do. So one of the things I like about Australian films is that sometimes you get films like this that are obviously made on a tight budget, but they're so full of energy and so fun to watch. What did you think about that?
I really enjoyed this movie. The energy was awesome. We did talk about the energy earlier in this podcast. And I think it's because the energy is so strong in this movie, it is a key point of what makes the movie great. The chemistry between everybody on camera and behind the camera, according to a lot of the documentaries that we watched. And one of the things that I really enjoy is the quirky sense of humor, for a lack of a better word, is very Australian. It's a very dry humor. It's a very witty humor. It's like a bluntness to their comedy that I think is really hilarious.
Yeah, I think it had a very fresh comedic outlook because of the two leads. Their delivery was really good. I can see why they got cast in these parts because their playoff of each other was really good, really fresh, very quick. There wasn't that stilted, I'm trying to be funny delivery that a lot of young performers try to do. And you can see there's a little roughness around their performance because they're just so new to the acting profession on screen. I found it was really funny. We were doing the little bit of the Where Are They Now? And Jo Kennedy, she has acted and continued to act and even directed and wrote a few things. Ross O'Donovan, you found on an interview with him not too long ago, from what I understand. And what did you learn?
I found out that Ross O'Donovan, which should not be confused with the Australian Twitch streamer.
Ross Donovan,
who's also Australian. Oh, I don't know what I said. But I found out that Ross O'Donovan is an auditor for the National Mental Health Services in Australia, which is pretty cool.
So about six months to a year after this, he, in the interview, you found out he was diagnosed with
bipolar disorder, and he went into a hospital, and then when he came out, he tried acting again, but he just didn't seem like he was fully in it, according to this interview.
And he decided to move on, which is really kind of cool because it's like, you know, a lot of times when you read stories about Where Are They Now, sometimes you kind of open up the article like, oh, what am I going to learn? And so it was kind of a nice, sweet story.
Yes, he's only 5 years older than you, Dad, and has 11 grandchildren.
Well, I better get going. No, you better get going.
No.
No, please don't.
They're all going to have fur and forepaws.
So when we watched this movie, it's like I was talking about how back in the day I would go to these theaters or I would rent movies like this from certain video stores in Seattle that were known to have more eclectic libraries, not just your average Blockbuster. And then we watched this other documentary the other day called The Last Blockbuster. And it kind of reminded me of how we used to be able to find movies and discover movies and how there was this community about sharing movies that has kind of disappeared now. And so I wanted to discuss a little bit about, because of this movie, it kind of brought this idea to the forefront. Some of the movies that I have really fond memories, like this movie was brought to me by your mom when we were dating, but there's all other movies that were friends that would say, hey, I went and saw this movie. You got to see this movie. Or I would go to certain video stores or there were groups that I knew that were loose confederation of friends that would, you know, say, hey, I went and saw this at a film festival, and when it comes out, or you got to see this. So I wanted to have a little quick discussion about how do you find movies like that nowadays? How do you go out and find random movies that aren't part of your normal viewing habit? Because one of the things that I find it's really hard for me to break out of when I'm watching streaming services is that their algorithm figures out, quote unquote, what I should be watching. And so I have to either delete my history to get a fresh new algorithm, or I have to actively go out and search for movies on these streaming services. So how do you, because you're my age, and when I was doing a lot of this stuff, how do you find films like this that are made now?
I'm pausing not for dramatic effect, but I'm trying to figure it out because I don't think I do. Because when we were putting the season together, it was a struggle for me to find movies that were cool and interesting to talk about that I had watched on my own. Usually, either you or mom show me some films. Because of these streaming services, there's not a lot of things that I show up. I do have to say other streaming services are better. Netflix hunkers you down in this algorithm. Amazon doesn't do it a lot as much, but granted, Amazon has a limited library. But I do have to say that a lot of the Bollywood films that I've watched have been because of Amazon, because Amazon Prime Video, for some reason, has a huge library section dedicated to Bollywood films. So that's pretty cool.
But those show up on your viewing thing now because you watched a Bollywood film. So
not necessarily, because Netflix has the because you've watched blah sections, and that's like the most of their main page. And then if you know of a film that they have, you can go into the search and search it out, and then it will eventually show up on your homepage as a continue watching, watch it again, or because you've watched blah section. But with Amazon, there's this continue watching or you already have watched line that's only one line, and then they have great movies, best movies, black and white movies sections. So that's pretty cool.
I understand what you're saying, and those are the two largest, probably the largest streaming services. And you're right, there are some smaller streaming services. I think Canopy is a great streaming service, which I really recommend for people out there. If you have a library card, you can get onto Canopy for free, and they give you free 8 rentals a month. And they're not a sponsor, so just letting you know, this is just me putting that out there.
I'm never going to have the same experience with movies as you have, because when I was a kid, by the time that I went into junior high, Blockbuster was over. Not even junior high, probably the second half of my elementary school.
Yeah, you were 8 and 9 when they started to close down. So yeah.
They didn't exist anymore. And then Redbox was supposed to be the next big thing, and Redbox didn't really take off because of the fact that we found out that they only had 5 Blockbuster films, and then the rest of the movies were like crappy horror films, which I now enjoy, but when you're 9, you don't really enjoy.
Well, I think the thing is, I think there's another thing about streaming services that I find is there's a lot of white noise in their selections. There's a lot of the same style of, when you watch one horror film that happens to be like, let's say it's like Parasite, you watch Parasite, the next day you come back to look, and there are so many just horror films thrown at you, which have nothing to do with Parasite, you know, because Parasite is considered in that genre, they'll just throw all these movies that you might like on your screen. And so you have to really sift through all that stuff to find your next choice, I think the thing is too, is like, well, I'm more interested. I don't want to be like the old man shouting out the clouds going, in my day, it was so much, because there was a lot of BS in my day too. I had to, you know, go down to downtown Seattle to one of the video stores that had a really cool library that I could rent independent foreign films from. And and ride all the way back, watch it, and then get it all the way back there for those late fees, because my day, there was late fees on everything. And so I'm not saying it wasn't this perfect thing, and you had to go search for things. People didn't have it. Sometimes you would go to places and they would have it in the wrong format, so you couldn't watch it. But I'm not saying it was perfect. There was more of a sense of you were searching this out and you were an active participant as part of it.
The same thing's happening now. It's just the location is different. Your location is in the physical world. Our location's in the internet because like you were saying about Parasite, if you enjoyed Parasite and you enjoyed a lot of, I'm going to say his name wrong, Bong Joon-ho. Is that how you say it? Bong Joon-ho.
I think that's close. Sorry if we mispronounced it.
You would have to, right now, like after Parasite, you have to go and search for his stuff on Netflix, Amazon, Canopy, Tubi, Pluto. You have to go and find his stuff if you want to continue down his filmography. And we have people telling us, who can actually go to the Cannes Festival and go to Sundance and things like that, going, this is going to be the next big movie, which is one of the reasons why I think Palm Springs, which has a very similar sense of humor to this movie, in my opinion, did so well on Hulu, is because people went to Sundance and told us this movie is going to be a great movie. And I always think that you can read about a movie and then somebody can tell you about a movie and you can still enjoy it and still be a film buff. I don't think you have to discover things on your own.
No, trust me. We didn't discover,
you did discover things on your own. But what I'm saying is, like, there's people like Quentin Tarantino who spotlighted Parasite's director before Parasite came out and things like that. So it's like, there are people who enjoy movies.
I'm not saying that we were like these coal miners in this dark cavern and we had to go find and dig our way through this stuff.
I'm saying that we are the coal diggers. I'm saying that you guys, I'm going to say this, had it pretty easy when it comes to movies.
Okay.
Well, it's probably the same. It's probably the same amount of difficultness, one in the physical realm and one on the internet. But the sense of, like, there's one location, you're going to get your movie. But with us, there's 2,000 streaming services, and sometimes in America, they don't have streaming rights, but in Australia, they do, or vice versa.
So there's two things that make me worried. One is with the video store dying. A lot of movies that you used to be able to walk into video stores and rent, that they would go out of circulation. These video stores had them as part of their catalog, and you were able to rent to a certain extent. Libraries have always had a video contingent, but they're not as good. I think what you're going to see, like what's happened with Scarecrow, these famous independent video stores might end up turning more into video libraries or video archives. You don't have to live in that city to rent from, that there will be a way for you to rent the movies. But back to the point where I was trying to talk about earlier, how you guys are seeing films now, is, and it kind of didn't answer the point. How do you share and become a community, really have that sense of discovery and community building around films that is kind of important for films and how they grow and how they become part of the consciousness? Like certain movies, we in my generation, we think of being huge hits, and they weren't. And the reason that we all talk about them is because we went to the video store when they came out, and the whole generation rented them. And I can point to tons of films that became touchstones because of the community that built up around them after the film came out. And a lot of this has to do with secondary and third markets. But now the secondary and third markets is very fractured. You go on your own streaming service. Somebody else is recommending it to you through an algorithm. You watch it. So you're not really talking to anybody. Nobody's ever coming to you saying, hey, I had this great movie, watch it. You guys don't sit there afterwards in another conversation, reminiscing about the movie, talking about the movie, There's none of that community building. That's what I was really talking about.
I disagree. I don't think there's community building in the sense of, like, discussion and talking about it. But you can't deny that the internet has definitely brought in a lot of people together. Like, the biggest one I could think about right now during the pandemic was that whole Ratatouille musical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ratatouille, everybody, the same thing. Ratatouille came out, it wasn't Pixar's biggest hit, and now it's like everybody's favorite because we all love food and we all understand where it's
coming
from.
Well, now we're all forced to cook for ourselves, so we...
Well, it was a hit before then, but yeah, sometimes we want a little rat on our head so our toast doesn't get burnt. But I think the internet has brought in movies into the 21st century, which I know sounds weird, because we're so divided throughout the whole world that things like the Ratatouille musical and TikTok and things like that bring in people of a certain community together, in the sense of, like, you know, there's like that stan culture now, and there's memes based on favorite books and favorite movies and things like that.
I do understand that social media and the internet have brought people together that would never have met, that are in different countries, different parts of the United States, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and all that stuff. What I'm talking about, though, is there those deep conversations about a film? I'm not talking about trading memes about that makes you think, oh yeah, that's hilarious about that film. I'm talking about, is there discussions? And I think there are. My suspicion is, because I'm with a bunch of people that talk about film all the time, I don't have to go out and find those groups. My suspicion is that those groups exist on social media and the internet. It seems to me, though, the more communal part of it, where you physically were in that room together, has been lost. And I'm hoping that that doesn't get lost completely. I hope it gets reinvented somehow.
I think YouTube has helped me a lot find my niche in movies, because a lot of people similar to us like talking about films and want to give suggestions and things. So it's like more of like a virtual Blockbuster employee. And so that's sometimes I get suggestions, and then I build on those suggestions and I go, oh, I really like this actor, let me go find his stuff. Oh, I really like this director, let me go find her stuff. I personally really enjoy the music, and you said that you enjoyed one of the songs, Want to Live in a House, which is a song that Angus sings. So did you really enjoy the music then versus now?
Yeah, I think the music choices were good. They matched the irreverent humor that was in the film. Some of them were very obvious, humorous takes on what was going on within the plot. And then some of them, when they had to be, like the love song that she sings, didn't rely on cliche. Every song fit what it needed to do. I know they had to rework some of the songs to make them sound like the sound that they wanted, and they did a really good job of doing that.
Even though this musical is not, this musical sounds like a jukebox musical.
Well, do you think it sounds like a jukebox musical because the fact that there's different bands playing music? Or do you think it's because there are songs that are definitely Australian New Wave and then there's ones that are more traditional musical?
I think the latter. I think because of the fact that there is definitely songs that are fitting of the Australian New Wave, it feels a little bit more, the story fits around the songs and the songs fit around the story instead, you know, does that make sense?
So what you're trying to say is that because they didn't write the music, they didn't write the film from having the songs and writing the story to fit the songs, but they wrote a story and then they put songs in there to fit, that it feels more like each song was maybe not connected to the other song.
Yes, exactly. You know, the same thing with like Moulin Rouge, another Baz Luhrmann movie, but not one that I really enjoy. But like, that's the thing that I, with Moulin Rouge, is that even though it's a great musical, according to some people, some of the songs don't fit together necessarily because of the fact that they're just inserting songs to fit into the story.
I think, like you stated earlier, the thing that interests you is how musicals are constructed. In this case, they had a story and then built songs into the story. I know that Singing in the Rain, one of the famous musicals in the 50s, they had a bunch of songs and they wanted to use them in a movie. So they built a movie around the songs. And then there's people who literally build the musical from the ground up with the songs and the book at the same time. They're telling the story and they're creating the songs to tell the story. So those are the three different ways that you can kind of build a musical. And I think it works in this film. Like you said, that there's an overriding feeling and sound.
So, Dad, would you recommend this movie? Do you think this movie holds up?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this movie does hold up. This is the thing. When you watch films and you know that they were made on a shoestring budget, I mean, I think they made this movie for like $250,000. Even back in 1982 terms, that's still not a big budget. I think after that was all said and done, it was, even with all the add-ons that they had to do to get it out into the theaters, it was less than $500,000, which is nothing in a film. So when you watch films like this and you watch, and we keep talking about the energy and the exuberance and the style of filmmaking, we know that we're talking about a film that has flaws. There are certain things that just the energy and the performances overcome. And I really think when you talk about movies, does this movie last? Yes, that energy lasts. It's like listening to a great punk album later on in life. You may not listen to punk every day anymore because you're older and more mature, and frankly, your ears can't handle it. But when every now and then you go back and you listen to that punk album, it takes you back. The energy's there, and you really have a fun time listening to it. So I think that's how I think it holds up. It's like, it's definitely a movie of its time, and it's so fun to go back and relive that moment and then move on.
I think it does hold up as well. I really enjoyed it. This is my first time watching it. And so as a Gen Z millennial hybrid, I could see this movie being really enjoyed today. I think it's a really interesting movie with a really great set design and artistic feel to it.
Oh man, we didn't even talk about that. We didn't talk about the guy who designed it.
You didn't write down in your notes.
I know. But I realized the guy who designed, so a lot of people don't realize the guy who designed this film is the same guy who designed Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes. And you can see it throughout the movie, in the sense of like the wall in her room is full of like a collage, and it's like super really, it's really cool. Yeah. And she's physically sleeping in a blow up pool full of sand on a floaty. Like, that's her bed.
Yeah. It's one of those quirky things that only would happen in an 80s film. I think the thing that his design helped is like when you go from like the trendy nightclub to her room and the bar and different places, there was obviously a sense of design for character in each of those spots. So you didn't feel like they were just recycling the same look everywhere. And it also lent to that energy, his design lent to that energy of the film, that even the rooms and the places they inhabited felt lived in and exciting, and they were visually part of the story. So, but yeah, that's one of the cool little tidbits. And another thing that we forgot to talk about was this was Jeffrey Rush's first part ever in a film. He played the stage manager at the TV show.
Yeah, he only has, what, two lines, but a hilarious physical comedy.
Oh, yeah, he is definitely, you can see that his roots in physical comedy and physical, just this movement is there.
Yeah, so it's kind of fun, it's kind of jarring to see him, you know, because he's famous for, like, The King's Speech and Barbossa from Pirates of the Caribbean.
All right, that was a really fun episode talking about Starstruck. I hope you guys check out this film. Like I said, it has a lot of energy and exuberance that I really enjoy and sometimes reminds me when I'm starting new projects. This is the type of attitude I need to have. Can do, and nothing will stop me.
We will be posting a new show every Tuesday. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, leave a review, and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. We also have a Facebook under The Movie Log. You can find all our socials and past episodes on The Movie Log A Journey Through Cinema.buzzsprout.com. Next week, we will be asking what's it all about in this 1966 British classic film, which started a beloved film actor's career.
Thanks for listening.
Follow us for more clues. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.